What's going on? What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We love to have you on board. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. Hot, hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks, get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. cheers. Clink, clink. We engage you, the listener, and interact on a different topic each week. We've got loads of good tunes, lovely music, and lots of analysis to keep you going.
And interviews from experts or you young people telling us what you think about our daily topic.
That's always the best part of the show, Jackson, to hear what the listeners have to say. There's always lots of juicy comments and lots of different perspectives. Absolutely.
So stay tuned. Welcome to Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, D.C. Now, there's an interesting proverb once quoted by the late Chinua Achebe that says, until the lions have their own historians, the history of the hunt will always glorify the hunter. Now, this statement essentially underscores the issue at the heart of all the historical and many times contemporary misinformation about African society and culture. It also speaks to the need to examine the cultural, historical, and socio-political contexts in which many an African cultural work and literature is produced and consumed. Contrary to popular belief, African people did not hear of culture for the first time from Europeans. In fact, we have always had a philosophy of great depth, value, and beauty. And so there's a need to capture this experience by writers who appreciate and understand a level of nuance that many Western writers may miss in their writing about Africa. But it shouldn't stop at writing. Writers need readers. And so the great challenge of writing an African story is to get it in the hands of an African reader. And so how do we encourage our writers to tell their stories with the assurance that they will have a local impact? And basically, how do we cultivate a culture of consuming works created by African storytellers? Because you see, writers are teachers. They're essentially teachers. They write because they have something to say to the world about our society for many reasons, whether they're moral, intellectual, idealistic, or cynical reasons. They essentially take on the task of recreating the time, the characters of whatever era they live in. For example, Chinua Achebe wrote about a pre-colonial and sometimes post-colonial Africa, the challenges of living in those two societies. And by writing about that era, he kept that era alive. He kept it alive for future generations so that our children, our grandchildren can understand who we really were, what we stood for, and the subconscious fears that drove our generation's actions. So today on the show, we will speak to writers of African descent about their inspiration, their challenges, and the audiences they intend to reach with their works. But the question to you as a listener, as we explore this topic, is how many works of African literature have you read so far? And how have they impacted you? What have you learned about your society through these works? This is Upfront on the Voice of America. Let's begin the conversation.
Yeah, the book that I read was Smooth and Chuckle, that was written by Tiambe Seriza. African literature always depicts what is happening on the ground, what is real on the ground. That's what I've learned from them.
Because when you read literature, at the end of the day, you have to learn something. However, in recent years, I've seen a lot of people liking books, but at the end of the day, you tend to wonder and ask, what exactly were these people trying to write? So as the likes of the late Chinua Achebe, at the end of the day, you find out that you have learned something that will help you in your life in the near future or present.
The African should get to write a little more because there is a general perception that Africans do not read. We lag behind because they do not get the information. I believe we should write more, encourage a little people to read what we write.
So while they fight you down, stand firm and give Jah thanks and praises. Cause I and I do expect to be justified,
by the laws of men, by the laws of men. Oh, should be found guilty but proved.
Welcome to Upfront on the Voice of America. I'm Nadia Sami in Joburg, South Africa, and Jackson Vungani is in Washington, D.C. Thank you all for joining us. But first, let's give a shout out to all our listeners who've contributed their opinions to today's show. We have listeners around the continent this week. We've had people sending in comments from Malawi, Kampala, Uganda, and Juba, South Sudan. We thank you for your valuable contributions to our show. You can also send in your opinions wherever you're listening from. Send us a message and let us know what's on your mind. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We're all over social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, or send us an email to upfront@voanews.com. Now, Jackson, many people on the continent read lots of literary works, fiction or nonfiction, written by Western authors. But it's also true that many African readers often feel alienated by the depictions of Africa found in these novels written by Western writers. There's also a persistent narrative in these books that cloud any possibility of a fair reflection of the complex nature of African society as we know it, as Africans living in Africa. We experience it our lives on a daily basis, and we read these books written by someone who isn't actually from Africa, you know, maybe in some cases has never been to Africa. And it's frustrating.
Fictional or non-fictional stories capture a unique aspect of a writer's society. For example, a horror writer will memorialize the discomforts of his era. A science fiction writer will demonstrate the era's view on technology of the time. A literary writer will display what everyday life was really like. In telling many of our stories, many Western writers have lost out on the nuances of our society. One of such societies has been Somalia, and for over 20 years it has been in the news for conflict that has claimed thousands of lives and displaced millions of others. But writer Abdilatif Egger, author of the book Guban, says that he was inspired to write about Somalia in his novel Guban to provide a context of the story that goes beyond the nomenclature of pirates, warlords, and terrorists.
I decided that, you know, that I needed to make human this this idea of what Somalia is within the Anglophone world and other places later on, but mainly to give an alternate narrative that is very real about Somalia. It's not just this essentialized view where all they have there is actually all the terrorists, pirates, and things like that. So that's what actually moved me, because what happened is that at the end of the day, that made it easier for the state, for example, to sanction militarism as a response to people rather than investigate other things.
Why do you feel that the West or Western writers who explored the story of Somalia were telling it differently, or were, and in other words, they were giving it a very different construction that you felt as a Somali that was not true?
Well, I think, you know, it's very simple. For example, how does one who's sitting in his living room in Washington, D.C., for example, relate to the figure of a pirate? You know, he must either go to Captain Cook or go to some form of time which is, you know, some incomprehensible to the mind. Mm. So that makes, in that identification of pirate, it creates a disconnect between that other person's humanity, because you know the regular person, anyone, it's very difficult for them to wrap their heads around what a pirate is in the 21st century. You see, and so having you know, saying that they're pirates and also warlords and all these are all figures from another time in history, and yet you're saying these are present with us today. It means that those people, whoever they are not people who are human like us. Because they're so far removed from progress.
Right, right. But that could be said also of any other, of a myriad other African stories too, or African experiences.
Yes, well, Well, I think that is different in that there are not too many other pirates all over the continent. That's one thing. You have to remember that there's a war on terror. Mm. So all these things were collectively bringing about a situation where that the public was completely detached from any humanity.
Right.
That belongs to the Somali, you know, and also that, you know, ultimately this is also an African figure, a black African figure, which means that lack of, for example, humanity is also affecting in the classical sense, you know, through Hollywood and all that continues to fuel that racism, or if you want to call it white man murder.
Right.
Yeah.
Because
it's not something... It's not something new.
Right. I was saying this not specifically for the story of Gobond of Somalia, but I was saying in general that there are many stories, experiences about Africans that because we don't write the stories ourselves, that there's a misinformation, and that if we rewrote the stories, we would be telling the stories differently.
Well, I think in two things. I think one is that the writers I was talking about, the major response has always been, for example, the most powerful is two things. Usually it is the mainstream media, people like you know, CNN, New York Times, and Hollywood is the second. These are the two largest mediums that, you know, influence a lot of people throughout the world. That's one part. Those are the media people, which are journalists and all. And then you have the writers. And there might also be African in the sense. It means that it means, are you when you're writing and penning these things, are you considering the history of the personality of Africans within the imagery of the United States or the Western books and media and things like that? If you are aware of this, then you are not going to add a dehumanizing figure to it and not be cognizant of doing that. You see, so and then what affects the writers today is that there seems to be pretty much a lot of funding and a lot of audience coming from the Western readership. You know, so you have all these writers who are writing these stories that are about child soldiers, about famine, about, you know, a lot of African brutality. But then again, it begs the question of the character's humanity or the people of all Africa's personality. Are you actually writing on at the behest of Africa, or are you writing at the behest of your Western audience?
There's a genuine perception that Africans do not trade. We lag behind because they do not get the information. I believe we should write more. Encourage a little people to read what we write.
Yeah, I happen to read, but a little. Especially looking at the aspect of Ugandans. First of all, we have few writers. The publicity, they need to come out to people, you know, get known.
There's no reading culture. There's no culture of writing. Generally, the reading culture in Africa is a minimum level. Maybe that's why we don't have those many ideas, because the more you read, the more ideas you get about different aspects. Generally, it's good to read. It's good to read. You learn a lot.
The fact that I can't name 10 African writers is a problem, and yet I'm in the university among the elite. So there's a general problem of reading.
Welcome back. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, D.C. Now, encouraging African literary works
involves a conscious effort to consume it. Writers need motivation to tell their stories, which is often the knowledge that people will read and relate to that story in some way. Tope Folarin is a young Nigerian-American writer. His first story, Miracle, won the Kane Prize. Miracle is a story set in Texas in an evangelical Nigerian church where the congregation has gathered to witness the healing powers of a blind pastor prophet. I reached Tope recently and we talked about his journey and motivation as a writer.
I guess I started writing when I was in grad school formally. I was actually just thinking about this a couple of days ago, about sort of the journey I've been on. And I think it's safe to say that up until grad school, there was a part of me that desperately wanted to write, that wanted to be an artist. And that's something that's been in me for as long as I can remember. But the other part of me, the part that had been conditioned by my Nigerian parents and growing up in a household in which grades were important, and grades were the most important thing, was convinced that writing and art in general was something that I really couldn't pursue for a career. And so the wonderful thing that happened to me when I went to Oxford is that I just had all this time to myself. So I began to read a lot of fiction, and that part of me that had always been excited about reading and excited about art was really energized. And I think it was at that point that I began to think, well, perhaps this is something I could do. I didn't fully commit to the path to becoming a writer then, but I certainly began to read a lot more than I ever had in my life. Began to write as well, and so that's when it started in earnest, I think.
Did you know what you wanted to write about? Did you have stories that you wanted to tell?
I suppose I did, but I think more than anything else, there was just this desire to create something, to sit in front of a laptop or a computer and write and compose something. That was what I felt more than a desire to tell a particular story. I think the idea that I needed to tell particular stories came later, but I just really wanted to create something beautiful. I think that's the first impulse I had.
I came to see you speak at the Capitol Hill.
Yes,
and
you
said something about a 600-page book. What's the story behind that?
I think, I may have mentioned my first novel.
Yes, your first novel.
Yeah. So I worked at Google after grad school. And at night when I wasn't doing stuff for Google, I was writing my novel, and the novel just kept growing longer and longer and longer. And I was convinced when I started writing it that it was going to be an incredibly important novel, that it was a novel that would break me. And I remember vividly after like a year of writing it, I was reading over some of what I'd written, and I thought, wow, this is complete mess. Like, there's nothing in here that's redeemable. And so that was a really painful moment because I had to put that away and sort of start from scratch. And actually after that, I began to read and write a lot of poetry, and it was after an extended engagement with poetry that I tried again to write a novel.
What were some of your first stories?
Yeah, I guess the first stories were short stories, and they were, as it happened, one of the first short stories I wrote was similar to Miracle, which is the story that won the Kane Prize.
Right.
But the first story I wrote was it was similar in that it was a church scene and something was happening at church. And I think it's interesting because I think within me, I wanted to tell a very particular story about what's happening to immigrants in America, and a story that kind of focused on religion in a way that I hadn't really read before. And so I wrote a story, but I just kind of sensed, even though I liked some of the language in it, that it wasn't quite capturing what I wanted it to capture. And the funny thing about it is that it took me, the failed novel and then a year and a half of reading and writing poetry and then starting again before I was able to tell the story that had been within me for quite a long time.
Now, did you read any African authors when you were in college or in high school?
In college and high school, I read Things Fall Apart, of course, in college. I read some Ben Okri, but I read him. I probably read a lot of the African writers that I came to love in grad school. I also read Nervous Conditions. I remember reading that my junior year in college and loving that book. But yeah, a lot of the African fiction, I became acquainted with it in grad school because, frankly, I took a couple English classes in college, and they emphasized works that by white male writers. I did have a great class. I spent a year at Bates College in Lewiston, Maine, and that was a wonderful class because it was an American fiction course, and so I read folks like James Baldwin for the first time, mm-hmm. Ellison for the first time, and that, I think, was an incredibly important step so that when I started engaging with the Africans, I was able to bring in this really interesting context about the way black people have been represented in American fiction and the way black writers are writing about the black experience as well.
What makes a story an African story? Is it the theme or the writer?
I have no idea. I don't know what an African story is, to be frank, because I never, ever think about that. I just think I want to write a story that is compelling and interesting and beautiful and that people want to read. But again, I didn't write the story thinking, this is an African story or this is something that at some point I can submit to the good folks of the Kane Prize. But this has all been a wonderful, I think, blessing for me.
Mutima yanje ni abizi Nzozi sanje ni ho wibera Singe fitu burcho biguisha So banki wibcho nyumfa kampe Wamvanye mungishi munjana mumucho Zakurutisha bakwegera Zakwambika imbeta y'ubutesi Umenye ko ndu Chindi chere chezo Bye 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 Urukundo rwagahararo
Things fall apart by Chinua Achebe in order to inspire the young talented writers and authors.
I do think that African writers should really go on writing because this really portrays how Africa has developed.
I'm not so good at African literature, but some books are eye-catching like Nadia by Sophie K. I think Africans should write more in order to improve on the literature and in order to keep the African culture existing and known for generations to come.
Well, at the moment on my bedside table, Jackson, is a little collection of short stories by Kan Temba. Kan Temba, another, you know, well-known South African author whose writings... really played a seminal role during the apartheid era in South Africa, capturing, you know, life in the townships, in Sophiatown, life underground. So it's really a mix of, it's journalistic work, but really reflective of what has happened, what we've gone through as a country. And so I really enjoy Kan Temba's short stories. And, it's easy. I pop it in my bag. Whenever I'm sitting around waiting, I can read one of his short stories. And it transports me to that time in our South African history. I don't know if we're seeing enough of African literature being prescribed reading in our schools, Jackson. I think we need to focus more on that. I think there's too much emphasis on Western authors.
If you're just joining us, we welcome you. Now, many young people say that their worldview is shaped mainly by Western storytellers. Their local experiences are rarely captured to tell a wholesome picture of who they are, their lives, their expectations. But does that have to do with the language in which we consume our literature, in which we read? Literary icon Ngugi wa Thiong'o tells me that salvaging of African languages and cultures is a necessary step toward the restoration of Africa's holistic selfhood. Restoration, he says, would mean translating European literatures and Europhone African intellectual productions into African indigenous languages.
When I talk of African languages, it doesn't mean that we shut ourselves in the languages. In other words, we use the language as a base from which we interact with other languages and cultures in the world. Yeah.
I guess the main problem we have right now is to be able to connect with our own languages.
Exactly.
At the same level as we do with these foreign languages that we speak.
I agree with you. And that's a problem, you know. And the question you raise, what happens to Africa then when its elite begins to negate African languages? Now, it just means, quite frankly, and I'm sorry to say this, that in some identity, there'll be no Africa of tomorrow. We shall be there physically as Africans, but we shall become part, in that identity, we shall simply become part of the English language-speaking communities, part of French-speaking communities. In other words, technically, we shall become a community of those who speak Frenchmen, those who speak English, Englishmen.
So colonization will have come full circle then?
In the terms of identity, yes. Yeah. Because we shall be calling ourselves, even when you call ourselves Africans, it really is like misnomer when we are entirely an English language speaking community or a French language speaking community, because language makes us be more part of that language community than it is, than, you know, the other way around. So what I'm trying to say again, language and identity are very, very important, but not identity as a way of saying I enclose myself within that identity, but identity as the base for interacting freely, creatively with other identities.
Would you say language is a thought process or an expression?
Two things here. First of all, it matters. Obviously, when you have got a language, at least that's a beginning, very, very important. But also to remember that the reason why we think that the thought process is more so in English or French is because, quite simply, we are used to conceptualizing ideas in English or French and so on. In other words, even when you're in school, like the school you mentioned, when people are trying to discuss ideas or write ideas or read about ideas, they did all those things in English in this case. Okay? So it's not surprising, then that when one comes to think of ideas later on which to build, one thinks in English and so on. But it can also happen the other way around, that the more used we are to African languages, the more we shall be thinking within those languages as well, or out of those languages.
Another literary icon from the continent is Nigerian writer Wallace Soyinka. The Africa Literature Prize is named after him. Wallace Soyinka's works have inspired many young writers from the continent. Mr. Soyinka says that he's excited about the new generation of African writers, and his suggestion is that if we're going to encourage a culture of reading, it should start from the infancy when they're still young, from primary school to secondary school all the way to college.
The initiative of creating reading societies, literary societies, catching them young, so to speak. But I think that is a way to create a truly literate and literature-conscious society, to catch them young, have competitions among them, award prizes to them, and also for established writers to make themselves available as much as they can, because their first mission is to write. We've got to emphasize that. But wherever and whenever possible, to make themselves available to young readers.
What is your assessment of some of the young writers that are coming in your footsteps, that look at you as a literary icon? There are some of them that you're reading, you enjoy reading.
Impressive and exciting. We have a bright young generation of crop of writers coming up all the time. As you probably know, an Africa Literature in Africa Prize was named after me, and opportunity to read some of those scripts. So in addition to what is being published, what gets to the public, I think we have a very bright future for literature on the African continent.
Thank you very much for listening to Upfront on the Voice of America. I would like to thank my co-host Nadia Sam in Johannesburg, South Africa. We would also like to thank all our listeners who contributed to the show this time around. And if you have any questions or comments or want to contribute to the show in future, remember to send us an email at upfront@voanews.com. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, my handle is @UpfrontAfrica. Let's connect again next week, right here, same time. On behalf of my colleague Nadia Sami, my name is...